Ministry of Supply. They offer a new generation of dress clothes using innovative materials, advanced manufacturing, and timeless aesthetics to help you feel comfortable at work all day. This is scientifically designed clothing for work-life balance. All Ministry of Supply clothing is machine washable, wrinkle-free, climate-controlled, soft and stretchy, and sustainably made. The soft and stretchy thing, that's important. It does feel like future clothes. It feels like something you saw in a 1960s science fiction movie, except in an office space. The more I think about it, no, you've never seen this in your entire life. It's soft and stretchy and futuristic and amazing, and you get $10 off of your first purchase of Ministry of Supply's scientifically better clothing by visiting ministryofsupply.com and entering the offer code YANSS. That's you are not so smart. So YANSS, $10 off your first purchase. ministryofsupply.com. Scientifically created work clothing. Let's do it, y'all. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 165. On this episode of the You're Not So Smart podcast, we welcome journalist Kate Lever.
My name is Kate Lever. I'm a journalist and author living in London.
So what kind of stuff do you usually write about?
I usually write about anything that is to do with women, pop culture, or mental health. That's just become kind of my specialty triage, if you will.
Kate is here to talk about her new book, The Friendship Cure, in which she explores the crippling, damaging, life-threatening impact of loneliness and the severe health impacts of living a life disconnected from a support network of close friendships. In the interview, we talk about loneliness and how to make friends, the difference between male and female friendships, platonic friendships, friends with benefits, and lots more. I really enjoyed this interview, and I think you will too. And this episode will be just a straight-up interview. It's just a conversation between me and Kate, and there's some ads about a third the way through. So let's just get right to it. Kate Lever and The Friendship Cure. And what got you interested in deep diving into the topic of friendship?
Actually, it started one day in 2015 when I was in Hyde Park in London, and I read an article that basically argued that as we get older and get married and have kids, we lose that kind of urgency and love for our friends, and that contributes to our loneliness epidemic that we're going through at the moment. Mm-hmm. And essentially, that article frightened me into a year-long binge of research, and I wrote an 83,000-word reply to that article. So it really just sort of was a very personal thing. And the first time I felt like I didn't have enough room to discover enough about a topic in just a feature article, I felt like there was a book in it.
Well, this is really, this is a topic I think that is on, is top of mind for a lot of people, and they may not realize it's top of mind for them because it's so hard to compare what you're experiencing in the modern world to what people experienced in previous generations. Even if we have, like, you know, television or movies or books to compare ourselves, you know, loneliness is such a private thing oftentimes that it's hard to portray effectively in a lot of different media. And our modern loneliness feels different. It feels like it has to be unique to our era and our technological, place and time. So if we can just start there, because I think this leads to what you're really writing about. Is it different? Is this just another way to look at the same old thing, or have things changed for us when it comes to loneliness?
I think that's such a lovely question. It is difficult to tell, of course, because we have only the kind of hindsight that our sort of parents and grandparents give us. And beyond that, we have to rely on history to try and get into it. And I think for many, many years, loneliness has been something that we haven't been candid or honest about. It's been such a very private thing. I think while I'm very reticent to blame social media for loneliness, and in fact, I often jump in and defend the internet, definitely as a millennial, it's my role in society to do that. But I think the sort of illusion of intimacy that we have through social media is making this a unique period in history with regards to loneliness, because I think we have a spike in loneliness. I think there's plenty of scientific evidence to say that it's affecting us both physically and mentally more than it ever has, and of course there's the argument that you know, we haven't had that level of research before. But nonetheless, I think the way we've structured modern society, the way we use technology when we're using it in an unhealthy way, and the way we've kind of tricked ourselves into thinking we have these enormous circles of friends when actually we only need a solid, you know, maybe five really good ones, has thrust us into an era of acute loneliness that I would say is probably unprecedented.
Well, this is a fascinating thing, the idea that we really need to curate and take care of this core group of people, 3, 5, 7, whatever you're fortunate enough to have. Because I know a lot of our time is spent curating this giant audience that we assume is liking our things, and maybe they are, depending on how much social cachet you have. But I know that over the last few years, I've gone through a number of, you know, traumatic life events, and the only thing that pulled me out of it was having a core group of friends who I eventually reached out to, and then they came and they delivered times a million everything I needed, and it brought us all closer together, and it made their friendships tighter and better even without me around. Mm-hmm. And made them more likely to reach out to each other. Is this something is this when you talk about the friendship cure, is this what you're talking about? Is this an aspect of it?
That is so beautifully and brilliantly exactly what I'm talking about. And I have to say, I'm particularly pleased to hear it coming from a man, because I think men tend to be generally sort of more reluctant to ask help when they ask for help when they need it, and to gather their friends around them when they need it. I think I say in the book, I kind of have, especially in the final chapter, a real call to arms for us to revive our urgency and respect for friendship. And I think and I say that it's the only thing that will save us from ourselves. And I stand by that, because I think exactly what you've spoken about there, this kind of potentially life-saving quality of friendship, is precisely why we cannot afford as a species to deprioritize it, or to let it kind of drift as we get distracted with different parts of our life, whether that's, you know, a romantic love relationship, the children we make if we decide to do that, the careers we build for ourselves, or just a sort of all-consuming sense of, I don't know, navel-gazing. I think Aristotle, you know, all those centuries ago, said that friendship was made out of going through hardship together. Now, he actually said you had to go to battle together, and he may have been talking about actual battle, but I like to think of it more figuratively. And I think going through something difficult like you did with your friends by your side is the most powerfully bonding thing that you can do. And I think you've proved to yourself, and I think anyone who's been through something traumatic and then had the support of their friends have proven to themselves just how vital and, yeah, potentially life-saving, I'll say that phrase again, life-saving, friendship can be. So that's precisely why I wrote the book, and precisely why I'm so sort of adamantly speaking about the subject and trying to get people to realize just how important friendship is.
Yes, over the course of the last few years, I've had friends tell me stories from their lives that they haven't told anyone, or they've kept inside them for 20 years. And I have relationships that are so much stronger with many of my male friends, especially who will randomly, no prompt, text me from time to time and say things like, thinking about you, love you, man, that kind of stuff. Like, that's it. And that's
so nice.
That sort of stuff was not happening for my entire life, right? Reading your book, I was thinking, like, everyone should have this, and it shouldn't take, you know, it did take something big, right? So instead of, I was trying to be stoic and standoffish, and it did take a long time to go over a hump. So the idea that this should be a fundamental value that we curate friendships in that way is absolutely something that resonated with me. And I love the way you wrote about it.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so pleased to hear that. I think, I mean, you know, I have a boyfriend and I love him very much. And I do say this in front of him, but the true loves of my life are the girlfriends that I've collected into my life, particularly throughout my 20s. And I have a core group of friends who unfortunately don't live geographically very close to me anymore, but whom I talk to most days, on my phone, on WhatsApp. And they remind me of the person I am and the person I want to be. And so long as I feel as though I belong in that group of people, then I know I'm on the right track. And that's so important and makes me sure of my identity and sure of what I want to do in this world. And I can't think of anything more powerful.
Well, I agree. And that's so good. So let's, before we talk about, because there's a question I want to ask you, we're going to get to it. I see this all the time, especially on places like Reddit, where if loneliness comes up, there will be people who will ask, like, well, how do I make friends, or what do I do, or, you know, that sort of thing. We're going to get there. But before we get there, I don't want to leave loneliness until we've kind of looked at it for a second, because you say something in the book. I think some people may be familiar with this, but it's always shocking if you've never heard it. Loneliness is life-threatening. What does that mean? If you could help us understand what that means.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most fascinating parts of my research for this book has been the science of loneliness, because I think we've always known that loneliness is heartbreaking and can be really difficult with regards to our mental health. But until quite recently, we haven't been paying attention to some of the research that suggests, or rather proves, that it's incredibly dangerous for our physical health. So it's something they, for instance, there's a very famous study from 2007 that happened in Australia, my home country, where they gathered together a group of breast cancer sufferers. And essentially, over the course of the study, they worked out how strong each person's social network was and how much they could rely on their friends. And over the course of the study, they were 50% more likely to survive if they had a stronger social network. Mm. There are similar studies that prove that friendship can actually extend our life and loneliness can actually cut our lives shorter. All sorts of research you can go into and that I cover in the book.
Yeah, you mentioned,
astonishing.
You mentioned heart attacks, stroke, diabetes, cholesterol, dementia.
Dementia, depression, anxiety, insomnia, basically any physical or mental ailment you can think of, it is detrimentally affected by loneliness. Loneliness is more dangerous than smoking 15 cigarettes a day and more closely linked to our mortality than smoking and obesity. And we have, you know, countless campaigns telling us, you know, to fight obesity and to quit smoking. Where are all the campaigns telling us it's desperately important for our health to make friends?
Well, So we're primates and we're gregarious and we need social grooming, and, you know, there's no solitary primate out there. Obviously this is going to hurt us to feel that, like, fear of being alone and truly being, if, you know, even if you haven't been ostracized, you're still getting the emotional responses that you would. And I think we have the urge, right? We want to connect to people. We don't want to be alone. I do see this oftentimes on internet forums where people will, if it gets to the subject of loneliness or it gets broached in some way, I can feel there are people who are online trying to get some, semblance of connection, but they want to meet and hang out and be around people and have these kind of friendships that we've been talking about, with the kind that, where you do randomly text people for no reason and just say, hey, I'm thinking about you. As someone who's written this book and has spent so much time with it, if a person like that was to ask you for advice, like, how do I get started? I moved to a new city. I took this nice job and, you know, on paper I'm successful, but I'm very sad and lonely and I would like to connect. What should they be doing?
That's such an important question. And since I've written the book, I've spoken to a lot of people in my own life and complete strangers who've asked me quite vulnerably, you know, how do I make friends, particularly as an adult? And I think it's actually easier than we think it is. I think social interaction can be incredibly daunting, but there are a few simple things. The first thing I encourage people to do if they want to make new friends is to do an audit of their existing life, because I think we let a lot of friendship opportunities go by. For instance, there was a really alarming study recently in the UK that said something like, and don't quote me on this because I might have got the number a little bit wrong, but something like 73% of us couldn't name someone who lives on our street. And I think neighbours are, well, for a start, the most convenient type of friend you could make. Geographically, logistically, being able to maintain a connection with them is going to be the easiest. I think we don't talk to each other on public transport. We don't, particularly in London, I've noticed, we don't sort of speak to strangers. There isn't a general sort of community sense that perhaps we used to have. We're losing a lot of public spaces like libraries and parks and community centres, but I think we need to do what we can to protect those spaces, because historically that's where we've met new people and made new friends. So I think looking at also deepening the relationships that you already have. I mean, we spend more of our life at work than we do anywhere else, and yet there are so many people we only say hi to in the lift and maybe have a quick conversation about whether we have weekend plans or, you know, how the kids are. And that's about as deep as our interactions get. So my other advice is to look at sort of the people you have around you in your workplace and wonder whether you could actually venture out of hours and invite someone for a drink or a coffee where you actually talk with some depth and intimacy about your personal life. And I know for many years we've had this kind of idea that you have to be stoic and have this kind of professional decorum in the workplace, but that's changing. I mean, our work is infiltrating every part of our life, and so long as we're answering emails at any hour of the day, I think we have the right now to make work personal. And I think if we're going to survive the kind of work culture we've got now, we need to have friends in that environment. So I think looking at friends that you could already have that you've missed, whether that's on your street or in your workplace, is where to start. And from there, I think you have to be proactive and strategic and smart about it. And I think it's as simple as joining a book club, joining a netball team, going to a yoga class regularly so you see the same people. Just literally putting yourself in the proximity of other human beings and giving yourself the best chance to meet new people. Yeah. And then, of course, it's being brave. And that is, you know, suggesting further social interaction with a human being that you actually like, whether that's at your boyfriend's sister's house party or someone you meet on Twitter. Speaking of which, the other thing, particularly, you know, you said someone moving to a new city. I moved to a new city a few years ago, and my single most effective way of making new friends was checking people out on Twitter, having a bit of banter, and then sort of sliding into their DMs to ask if they wanted to go for a coffee. And that's resulted in some genuinely long-lasting and delightful friendships. So that's my other advice, is to use technology intelligently.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that for a second, because this is something, it's very easy to become a naysayer. And of course, there's a lot of things, there's a whole lot of many aspects of social media that feel like soul poison. But you advocate throughout the book that, you know, it's just a tool and there are other ways to use it. What are some better practices when it comes to social media if you're trying to steer in the direction of the sort of things that you're writing about?
Well, I think social media is really interesting because I think it can be extremely noxious, as you say, but I think it can also have this wonderful potential for connecting us. I think particularly if you're an introvert, if you're socially anxious, if you have any mental health issues, if you live with a disability, if you have autism, any of these sorts of things, they're particularly good for vulnerable people, as well as just anyone in the world existing. It can be a portal into new connections, and it can be a way to audition people to be your friend in real life. So I think, I mean, the best advice for using social media in a way that's not detrimental to your mental health is to be really aware of the way you're using it. I think studies say, there are a lot of studies to do with social media. Obviously, it's a very trendy area of research at the moment. But there's a lot to say that actually our passive use of social media is the most detrimental. So that's when we're just, you know, lying in bed first thing, scrolling through Instagram and looking at the highlight reels of other people and then comparing it to ourselves as we're lying there in our pajamas, being our least glamorous selves mm-hmm. and perhaps not feeling, you know, our greatest. So I think there's a lot of time we waste on social media just scrolling through, reading other people's posts. Whereas there's evidence now that being active on social media and being very conscious of what you're putting out into the world, as well as using it to actually engage with people rather than just kind of lazily looking at their lives through your smartphone, that can be really healthy and really helpful in terms of fostering actual connection with people. So I would say, first of all, look at the way you're using social media, because I don't think we sort of stop and take stock of our own habits when we're scrolling through. And I think we can be, you know, really complacent about it and put ourselves in danger of comparing ourselves, you know, really harming our self-esteem and our sense of identity and confidence. So I think if you're aware of that, if you're putting lovely things that are on your own personal brand, if you need to have a personal brand, out into the world, and I think if you're using it to actually track down old friends on Facebook or make new friends on Twitter or, you know, comment on other people's photos on Instagram, then that's a totally different experience because you are actually connecting people. And it might not be face-to-face, but it's still a valid social interaction. Mm-hmm. So that would be my best advice, is to sort of do a little audit of how your behavior affects you on social media and maybe even use one of those apps that that records how much time you spend on social media, and perhaps do a little check-in with yourself about what your mood is after you've had a little scroll or a little social media session and just change the way you use it if it's not making you feel happy.
Yeah, I'm always wary of the technological poo-poo because they, you know, the telephone is a piece of technology.
So it's the wireless radio.
I mean, it's like, of course, you know, you call up someone and give and have a meaningful, you know, you call your mom and nobody, you know, the technology disappears. And the idea that you blaming the technology for the behavior is often an easy way out.
I agree.
Clay Shirky said that technology doesn't create behavior, it lowers the barriers to exhibit it. So the, you know, it makes it very easy to do things that we would have done anyway if we could have.
Yes.
And so when you have total freedom to do things that you used to not, it requires a new kind of self-control, and it requires a new kind of literacy for life itself. And so, I've often felt that we've been living through an interim period of being handed these tools and with no instruction manual, and we've done a lot of stupid things with them. But we also There's a lot of potential to do some really nice things too.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Well, there's something I wanted to ask you here, which is, you say there's a big difference between being alone and being lonely. Being happy and self-sufficient alone is not the same as feeling alone in a group of people. If you could just expand on those ideas, because I think it's worth noting, I think that's a feeling that sometimes people get and they feel like they're the only person that's ever felt it in the history of humanity. And seeing it written in a book, it does make you feel better. So if you could just expand on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. I think loneliness, I like to call loneliness a really sneaky bastard because mm-hmm. If I personify it in my mind, it makes more sense of it and it allows me to articulate a little better. And I think one of the cruelest things about loneliness is that it tricks you into thinking you're the only person who's ever felt that way in the history of the world. And of course, that is only isolating you more and making you feel more alone and more unique in this struggle. Whereas realistically, so very many of us have that feeling. And really, if we could trick loneliness in return and unite in this feeling that we have, we could beat it. And I think one of the most important things to understand about loneliness, and I do think we are still trying to understand it, we're at that stage of the conversation, is that it is possible to be lonely in the company of other people. You can be lonely at a wedding with 200 guests. You can be lonely at your own birthday party. And you can certainly be lonely in a relationship that should be loving but isn't. And I think you know, when we work in the loneliness space, there are certain experts who say that there's a difference between social isolation and loneliness. So to be lonely, it's not a prerequisite for you to actually be physically on your own, though, of course, there are people in our society who are socially isolated, particularly the elderly and people who live with disabilities, people who are carers for the disabled. There are lots of sort of groups in our society who are socially isolated, and loneliness is, of course, a problem for them as well. But I think the most powerful thing about loneliness as a facet of human nature is that it can exist at any time. It does not discriminate. It comes after you no matter what your income is, no matter what postcode you grew up in, no matter how old you are or what your circumstance is in life. And I think we're dealing with a very, very powerful force, and one that we don't fully understand. And it is, of course, and I'm so pleased that it sort of resonated with you for me to say things like this in the book, because I think the more we can say out loud what loneliness feels like, the less alone we tend to feel. Because as you said, and as I completely agree, loneliness does con you into thinking you're the only one who feels that way. So it's incredibly important to be speaking about this sort of thing. My favorite description of what loneliness feels like comes from a woman called Amy. And she said, I don't know if you've ever been to a silent disco, but a silent disco is basically, it's like a normal disco, except there's no music playing in the room. The music comes through headphones that each person is wearing. So you can have this weird experience where you take off the headphones and just watch people dancing in silence. Amy said to me that loneliness feels to her as though she's the only one in the room who can't hear the music. So she's in a crowded room, but she feels like there's something wrong, and she's the only person who can't dance and be in the moment and hear what everyone else is hearing. And imagine, if you take that literally, what an alienating experience that would be. If you sort of expand that out more figuratively, that's what loneliness feels like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like it's a deficit of having one-on-one time, and oftentimes, right? And then, it's really hard to go from I need some one-on-one time to, oh, I'm in a group of 20 people, and you have to be performative in that group if you want to hang out. You have to be having a good time, and you don't want to be the one who's like, hey, I'm kind of going through something, because then you're not having a good time. And now you're going to make everyone else not have a good time. And so then it starts this feedback loop, and you just kind of want to get away and go, look, I just don't need to be here. And there's, oddly enough, when it is time for you to have this one-on-one time with someone who you know you can be empathetic to, and they can reciprocate that empathy. I often think, you're walking around in your apartment or your house, and you're thinking how you would like to reach out to someone, maybe someone in particular. And I often think that in those times, and you think to yourself, well, they're probably busy, or well, maybe I shouldn't do that right now, or well, maybe I don't want to put this on them. I think sometimes they're often on the other side of that. I like to think that sometimes they're thinking the same thing. And there's two people who are like, they would like to reach out to each other, and they're convinced that their internal dialogue is accurate. They're reasoning alone and tricking themselves into having some sort of certainty about something. And if they would just talk to the other person or just reach out, they'd be a shock to realize the other person would like to commiserate. I feel like that, and I say that only because I've experienced it. And the other person is always extremely happy you reached out. And then, and you move things forward, and you're less likely to do it in the future. I guess what I'm trying to get to is to just piggyback off of what you're saying is, make the phone call or do the text, just do it, just give it a shot. The only thing that's going to happen if it doesn't work out is you will still spend that night, marathoning Netflix by yourself. Nothing's going to change that. That's your worst case scenario will still happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so important. And that's really, apart from perhaps like a whole shift in the way society approaches friendship, that's really what I wanted to achieve in writing the book, is that perhaps someone would pick up the phone and call or text someone and feel as though, you know, they don't have to listen to that internal monologue that tells them that they shouldn't do it, or that someone's going to think they're too keen, or that they don't want to hear from them, or that they don't need to because they've got more friends than they need. Whereas in reality, you know, most people are going to be completely delighted to be contacted, to have a gesture of friendship offered to them. And I think so important, you know, it's my greatest hope that people will put down my book and pick up the phone and try and connect with someone. I think equally, we need to get better at alone time. You know, in my own experience, whenever I spend time on my own, in my own company, I'm sort of scrolling through the internet, sort of half connecting with people in a virtual sense, or binging something on Netflix, which I think is a very noble and wonderful activity, but perhaps not the best way of actually spending time on your own and sitting with yourself and your thoughts and reflecting on who you are and what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. I think we have a tendency to like rely on distraction even when we're in our own company. So I think we need to get better at connection, but I also think we need to get better at disconnection, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. There's a I have no problem playing video games and watching Netflix or cruising the internet. I have no problem with any of it, except when it's being used for a nefarious purpose, which is to avoid that bad feeling you're having, or to avoid working through a thing. And I don't expect people to work through a thing in one afternoon. You do it in bursts, and then you can go watch Netflix. It's fine. But completely avoiding it is just pushing it down the line. It's going to get to you eventually. We have better. I understand that we live in an era where we're more likely to be alone than ever. And so you are alone with your thoughts more than ever. And that means that does require a kind of a skill set, a meditative skill set that is unique to our era, I believe, unless you've Thoreau or something, right? So unless you've had some intense hermitage and you went on like a expedition to the Arctic, I think, or, you know, you crossed the ocean and you had a private cabin. I don't know if you have any advice for how to be better at being alone. You know, if we're saying like, don't rush to the phone and rush to the TV to avoid some rumination, do you have any advice for like a person who is a complete novice at this, how to be, just what's some like best practices to get started at being better at working through things on your own without having to distract yourself?
Well, I think for a start, it's about being self-aware. So few of us are truly self-aware, and I think it probably requires quite a bit of therapy to get to that stage. But I think for a beginner in terms of wanting to spend time on your own, I think looking at your habits and thinking, why am I watching hours and hours of Sex and the City on Netflix? Or why am I playing this video game for hours and hours? What am I trying to avoid? That's a really good question to start with. From there, I think it's really important to experiment with some different activities in your own company. So I'm too fidgety to do meditation or mindfulness. That just kind of makes me a little bit claustrophobic and anxious, and I find it too confronting. But I have found that going for a long walk with my dog, or even, you know, I swam laps today and had to be in my own head with my own thoughts. Those sorts of activities are really helpful. Or, you know, sometimes I have a bubble bath and listen to Harry Styles in my bathroom. those things work for me. I think if you're trying to spend more time in your own company, trying out some things that involve silence, that involve movement, that involve genuine contemplation rather than a constant stream of distraction is going to be a really good place to start. I mean, my language of love is television. Mm. I watch hours and hours of it. And certainly if I'm depressed or anxious or if there's something on my mind, I could sit there for hours and hours, and I should probably win some kind of award for my for the endurance that I have for television. But I also know that I'm distracting myself, and that sometimes I need to go silently without listening to a podcast and just walk in nature until I've confronted some of my own feelings. So I would suggest that people do that. And that, you know, I don't know, it might be meditation, it might be walking, it might be swimming, it might be dancing. It doesn't have to always be exercise. Maybe it's a sort of mindfulness where you can just sit in your own company and have a think. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be extreme about it. You don't have to, you know, go on an expedition to the Arctic on your own and, you know, write a memoir about it. You can just introduce some small pockets of time into your life where you are actually in your own company. And, you know, put your phone on airplane mode so that you can't be interrupted, or put it in another room. Just banish it from wherever you are. Leave it at home if you go out of the house. Find a way to have a bit of actual genuine me time, though I hate that phrase.
I agree with you on this. Like, the phone's got to go. I mean, it's got to go. Yeah. Whatever it is, whatever you pick, even if you just, I mean, for me, I had a great moment. I had something that really worked for me was driving across country and driving back again. I had a couple audiobooks, but oftentimes I would just be silent in the car. But the phone had to be off. And it's huge. It's huge. Even if you're reading or, you know, having a meal or anything, this period of time that you're talking about, the phone's got to go.
I agree. I mean, it can be anything. My sister recently discovered that she likes to carve spoons. That's not something that you would sort of naturally go to as a young woman as a hobby, but that works for her. You know, just try, find some kind of activity. And while I'm on the topic of a hobby, I don't mean, you know, a new revenue stream or a side hustle or a second job. I mean, genuinely find something that you're terrible at to begin with, but something you really enjoy.
That's good. That's really good advice. I like that. Find something you're terrible at, but that you enjoy. That is good.
Liberating.
And do not try to make money at it. Stop it. Stop it.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just getting back on the wheel. Stop.
And now we take a break from our program for a word from our sponsor.
I could not be happier about having a new advertiser called Mel Science. Mel, M-E-L, Mel Science is a chemistry subscription service. I know that sounds strange, but it's chemistry as in science kits, as in chemistry labs that come to your house that you can play with. Mel Science is a chemistry subscription service that sends you monthly experiments to do with your kids. Or if you have one, your kid, your child. It's a great way to engage children in science early, to educate them in a joyful manner, get them to conduct real scientific experiments with their own hands. And listen, they sent me a kit with two experiments. I did it. I loved it. I put on the goggles. I had the tongs, I had the gloves, I had the beakers, all this stuff comes in the mail. You get all these cool things. You get this little lab that you get to play with. I did the experiment that makes the crazy charcoal looking snake thing that goes all across the room. And I did another one that made sort of a volcano thing. But you get to feel like a scientist as you're doing it. There's an app. There are goggles. Did I mention the goggles? It really feels cool. In the first box, every subscriber gets a starter kit with all the necessary equipment, including a free virtual reality headset to use with the free virtual reality science lessons. There are more than 30 chemistry topics in experiments like assembling a functioning battery, growing crystals, launching a mini rocket. This is the coolest thing ever. Here's what I like most about it. They really play up the fact that this is science. They don't make it some cutesy thing that, you know, they hide that there are chemicals involved. They hide that there's molecules and atoms and safety. No, you feel like you are doing science, and that's because you are. And you get to keep all the stuff. You get to have a science lab that you're going to reuse over and over again. I love it. I know it is something you're supposed to do with kids, but I look forward to getting another kit in the mail. And I learned just recently I'm going to get another one. And I will share the pictures of the experiments that I did on the episode, the post for this episode on the website, yournotsosmart.com. I will send you the pictures. I'll put the pictures up for you to see. Are you ready to do this yourself? I hope so, because if you want to get started, it's easy. And also, you're going to get 25% off and a free starter kit and a free virtual reality headset and free shipping if you text David, that's me, David, to 64000, 64,000. Text David to 64,000 and you'll get 25% off, a free starter kit, free virtual reality headset, and free shipping. This is a very special offer just for this podcast from Mel Science, M-E-L Science. Go to their website if you don't believe me. It's really cool stuff. And you support this show when you support this sponsor by doing this. Text David, D-A-V-I-D, to 64,000. And remember, there may be like a message or data rate thing that would apply to this, but it doesn't matter. You're getting all this great stuff. And I love this advertiser. I hope we get more toys from them soon. Mel Science. Try it right now. Oh, it's time for an old favorite called the Great Courses Plus. The Great Courses Plus. I love them. I love them so much. This is something I get to use and enjoy and spread the word about, have on the show. There's an infinite amount of information uploaded to the internet every day. You will never get through it all. There's like a day and a half. Last time I checked, these numbers may be bigger now. There's like a day and a half of video uploaded every second to YouTube. You're never going to see all this. We used to put the good videos, the cool videos, on jump drives. Really, we did this. And we would pass them around, go to other people's houses and say, have you seen this? Not anymore. An infinite amount of information is being uploaded to the internet every day. So it is hard to know what should you be looking at? What's accurate? What can actually be nourishing? That's why you need the Great Courses Plus. That's why you need this service. It's a streaming service that offers thousands of objective, unbiased lectures from respected professors who really know things. They know what they're talking about, and you're going to get the straight information from them. You get expert perspectives on topics ranging from human personality traits to microbiology, from stress management to building a better vocabulary, and more. The best part, though, is you can watch or listen anytime, anywhere, with the Great Courses Plus app. Now, I recommend this course in particular, Outsmart Yourself, Brain-Based Strategies for a Better You. It explores how our brains work and scientifically proven brain hacks we can use to make lasting changes in our behaviors. Now, sometimes I don't like this term, the idea of brain hacks, to like manipulate how your brain works. But with this thing from the Great Courses Plus, it's actually really cool. What do you get in this course? Well, you get 24 lectures. How about that? 24 at 31 minutes each. What kind of stuff? How about how framing changes your decisions? How language changes your brain? How to use your body to alter your mind? How to overcome your aging brain? Taking sleep challenges, boosting insights and creativity, training yourself like a dog. I don't feel like I need to say anything else. Training yourself like a dog is a 31-minute long lecture taught by a professor at a university named Peter M. Vishton, PhD, in a course that you can watch for free if you use the special code. Why would you not do this? I'm doing this. I want you to join me and let's talk about it on the internet. Stop second guessing and sign up right now for the Great Courses Plus, because right now my listeners get a full month of unlimited access for, let me tabulate this on the calculator, nothing. Right now my listeners get a full month for free just by signing up at this URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. That is thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart.
And now we return to our program.
I'm David McRaney. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast, and we're going to pick right up where we left off with our conversation with journalist Kate Lever, author of The Friendship Cure. I would like to move on to the discussion of, the differences between friendships between women and friendships between men. And so we don't have to do any of the tap dancing. I acknowledge that this is era-specific and culture-specific, and all sorts of things play into it. But regardless of those things, living here now in our culture as it is, there are definitely differences between the way men and women interact in these core friendship groups that we're talking about, the people you can depend on and you can talk to and you can share empathy with. So through your research and through your interviews, let's start with female friendships. tell me some things that are that came through in your writing that you found seemed to be universal, at least among the groups that you spoke with, and unique and interesting and strange and funny and bizarre. Just jump into it.
Okay, so I could start a fan club for female friendship. I honestly just have the most respect for something beautiful that happens when two women, become close. I spoke to a lot of women for the book, both people I know in my personal life, my dearest friends in the world, as well as complete strangers that I met on the internet or through sort of call-outs for different content. And the more women I spoke to about their friendships, the more I started to notice patterns and trends. And I think compared to men, women are more sort of socially conditioned to be communicators. So we're more likely to sit across from one another drinking coffee or drinking rosé and trying to put the world to rights. And we have a language, we have an ease with intimacy, and we are able as women to make ourselves more vulnerable than I think we give permission to men to be. So I think one of the most beautiful things about female friendship is the way it sort of reminds us of who we are, because the solidarity of the sisterhood is built on shared experience. And unfortunately, in this time, as in many times before it, that shared experience is one of misogyny, one of sexism, one of fear, one of anger. Mm-hmm. I think, for instance, the movement that we call the Me Too movement or the Time's Up movement, this whole conversation sort of post-Weinstein about sexual harassment and about sexual assault, I think that has been a gesture of the sisterhood. I think that is a movement of anger and fear and love that is based primarily on female friendship, because we're talking to one another, and that's a very special skill that women are particularly good at. We're listening to one another. And that, again and again, is what I kept coming up against in my research. I kept finding women who listen to each other and talk to each other in the most beautiful and powerful way. And I think you can look at that in a microcosm in our own lives. You know, the way I use my WhatsApp group with my best girlfriends to talk about, you know, how to get a promotion at work, but also how to tell someone tell a man that they've touched us in an inappropriate way, or how to feel safe when we're walking home in a public, you know, public street. Basically, we use female friendship and the connection we have there as a way to negotiate the often inconvenient and frightening experience of being female. So I think it's sort of a survival mechanism. And I think for a very long time, female friendship has been portrayed as being catty or bitchy or petty. And there are a lot of movies, a lot of books that really rely on this kind of stereotype of women being competitive and being cruel to one another. And the more research I've done, and certainly in my own personal experience, that is just not as common as we think it is. Mm-hmm. More often than not, female friendship is an incredibly calm, resilient, strong, and powerful thing, and it's a real force to be reckoned with. Mm-hmm. I think it's allowing a lot of women to get through lives where they may not otherwise get through. You know, my girlfriends are my lifeline, and I think that a lot of people would say the same about theirs.
And you write in the book that there's something in the difference. There's something unique in here that men respond to anxiety with fear, fight or flight, and fear, mm-hmm. fight or flight, while women tend to respond with tend and befriend. Could you expand on that for us?
Yeah, so there's this lovely study by a scientist called Laura Cassino Klein and her associates. It was sort of a big research team on this. And essentially they looked at this idea we have of fight or flight as a survival instinct. And they came to the conclusion that a lot of studies that we've done were mainly done on men. I think there was 64% male studies. So we don't actually know that that is necessarily what women do. We know that men have a fight or flight tendency, and that is sort of something we use colloquially, but is originally just the idea that if you're presented with an obstacle or a sense of danger, and originally that might have been, you know, a tiger or a tribe that you don't know in terms of sort of the first human beings, but now can apply to any kind of obstacle or challenge. But basically, when you're presented with danger, you either run away from it or you fight and confront that danger. And those are our two instincts. Whereas this research team sort of looked at the way women might react to danger and decided that it might be very different. So they have called it tend and befriend. So in the face of danger, they found and they suggest that women either tend to the babies, the children that they have, if they've made that decision, the families that they've brought up, or they make friends. So they go to other women as a survival technique. And certainly in earlier times in humanity, having female friends and having the protection of a group and the safety in numbers was literally, a matter of life or death. Mm. And I would say the same is true now. And I think it's really interesting because, you know, when we talk about fight or flight, we often use the example of a tiger or a bear confronting a man, whereas actually statistically, the greatest danger to any woman is usually a man, and usually then the man that she loves or is in a relationship with. So it's this idea that we can protect ourselves with female solidarity, and that is actually a primal instinct, not just kind of a socially conditioned role that we might fill. Mm-hmm. So that's been a really fascinating study, and I spoke to the lead researcher on that, and she did the study in 2000 actually, and I wanted to know sort of what had changed since then. And basically she had lived out her own research because she was, you know, a woman in a very male dominated department at a university, the evolutionary psychology department. So she sort of had to deal with being an object of sexism. She was also left by her husband while she was ill, and she had a few children under the age of 5 and had to raise them by herself. And she found that her instinct in those times of trauma and fear and challenge was to tend to her family and then rely on her friends. So she kind of, you know, did the science first and then lived it out in her own life, which I thought was really interesting.
There is something happening in our culture when it comes to male friendship as well, which is, as you talk about a lot in the book, not only is it, you talk about Brad Pitt and Clooney and Damon and Affleck and Wilson and Stiller and my favorite, Stewart and McKellen. And also, you know, J.D. and Turk, as far as fiction, you know, that was a big difference there. They've definitely, the J.D. and Turk relationship on television was a completely, there may have been other examples, but I feel like it was the one that was like, oh, wow, something has changed about how male friendship is represented in media. That their friendship on Scrubs was like nothing I'd ever seen before.
I've spoken to so many men who feel exactly the same way. They've just never seen that kind of love and intimacy between two men in a kind of like unapologetic, shamelessly close way, and with such humor and gentleness as well.
Yeah, and they never had, you know, there was a they had the foil of the doctor from the previous generation, you know, who rolled his eyes at them and called them names, which helped, I think, allow that to happen. With, you know, by giving them a fictional foil, it helped reduce like some counter arguing in the audience. But there is something you talk about a lot in the book, and that speaks to is that then you write in the book, you call it this intimacy deficiency, a crisis of connection, that even when men have friends, they don't have this thing. They don't have this next level experience. They don't have a JD and Turk relationship with anybody. And women tend to be able to have that relationship more easily, and men tend to stop themselves or they stop each other. Sometimes it's because it's some weird thing about homophobia. Sometimes it's the expectation that you have to remain a certain kind of stoic or you're not going to be accepted by other people or by women. Yeah, definitely so. A lot of men don't go the next step because they don't want to be looked at as less masculine by women. But you tell the story about I think it was a professor who was showing, or may have been a teacher who was showing a classroom some material, and there was a child who was a boy who was sharing himself, sharing his emotions, and the class laughed. And somebody said that they wish they didn't have to be so emotionless. Just jump in there and talk to us about that for a bit.
Yeah, so I spoke to an academic, a female academic in the States, and I'm so sorry, but I cannot remember her name off the top of my head right now. But she had spent 30 years basically talking to young boys about friendship, about what they wanted for friendship, what they were losing once they got older, and what they were getting from friendship. And she spoke to her classroom. She spoke at a sort of underprivileged high school to sort of, I think, maybe 13, 14-year-olds. And she read to them a passage that was written by a young boy about his best friend. He was a bit younger than them, but he was talking about how he loved his best friend and how much he meant to them. And basically, they all laughed because they thought this kid sounded gay. And one of the kids put up their hand and said, you know, is this kid gay? And the teacher had to explain, you know, no, I do not know his sexuality, but it's not relevant right now. But let's have a little look at your reaction and wonder why we think intimacy between two boys should automatically, you know, equal homosexuality, when actually it could just be a completely lovely, intimate friendship in a very platonic sense. So it's just, I think, really indicative of the kind of discomfort that a lot of young boys and then young men and then older men tend to have inbuilt into their egos, where they feel uncomfortable about being close with another man. Some of the men I spoke to, and certainly some of the researchers I spoke to, spoke about how many men they'd spoken to who were frightened of coming on too strong when making friends with another man, and frightened that they would think that they were gay. Mm-hmm. So there is certainly this kind of internalized homophobia about their own intimacy with other men. And the female researcher I spoke to, who'd spent 3 decades studying exactly this, has declared that we have a deficiency in intimacy for young men, and that as children, boys crave the kind of intimacy, the same kind of intimacy that women, that the girls do, that as children we're exactly the same. We want to be best friends with someone. We want to have that closeness in the playground and then for sleepovers and, you know, playing at one another's houses. We want to have that camaraderie that is so close and so idiosyncratic of children and childish behavior. But then when we get to those teenage years and adolescence kicks in, we start to socially condition young boys to be stoic and to be tough and to uphold this idea of masculinity that says they can't have that anymore. So they sort of start to believe that they have to behave in a certain way, and that way is to be distant, is to be cold, is to be strong above all else. And they kind of lose the ability to be vulnerable with ease. Whereas women are taught to be communicators, we're taught it's okay to be close to other women, we're taught it's okay to love our families, we're taught it's okay to be vulnerable in front of other human beings. So there suddenly becomes this great friendship gender gap, if you will, where as we're becoming adults and working out who we want to be in the world, men suddenly sort of lose the ability to connect with one another. And if that is replaced by fear of getting too close to other men, where women just continue to get better and more resilient and better at sort of becoming close with one another.
Yeah,
and of course, yeah. I'm making huge sweeping generalizations about gender to make a point, but you kind of have to in this kind of conversation.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about the differences, not the similarities. So,
yeah.
That's where you find, you know, that's where you figure things out, is that the even if these things are only 20% differences, it's still, you know, magnified over the course of a civilization and millions of people, it can be humongous. It causes, and then you add cultural impacts and feedback loops, and yeah, it's important to talk about. So yeah, but yeah, good on you there to definitely acknowledge that. Is this similar to what you're saying in the book? You say male friendships tend to be shoulder to shoulder, women's friendships tend to be face to face.
Yeah, that to me was one of the clearest ways of putting it. I think men tend to be shoulder to shoulder against the world. They tend to walk alongside, figuratively, alongside one another. They tend to do activities together to bond. They tend to have external things that allow them to get together. Whereas women tend to sit face to face, both literally and figuratively, you know, at a table. They're more likely to sit opposite one another and chat for hours. Mm. They're more sort of, they confront one another and tend to be more intimate in the way they speak.
Mm-hmm.
So that is definitely the biggest difference that I have seen, both in my personal observations and in talking to people who've spent their academic lives you know, researching this stuff.
Well, this brings me to something that I want to talk about before we head out, and then we'll head out with some happy stuff about Sardinia. So there's a way to kind of like get the best of both worlds here, which is for men to be friends with women. What a crazy idea. And we have a long history of Western literature and movies and stuff like that that say like that might not actually be possible. We even have like a very famous movie that straight up makes that its central thesis that that's not a possible thing.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. And there is this one thing I want to get to. I'll bring it back up if we forget. I think my favorite line in your book is "Our flaws belong somewhere." Really like the idea that two people can't be partners, but that they can be great friends because there's just something about their flaws that they can't get over. Or, you know, there's just something that their prickly bits just don't match up. But your flaws belong somewhere. And I love that line. So if you could just jump into platonic friendships and what you've learned about them.
Yeah. So I did a lot of research to try and answer the question, the eternal question that we don't seem to have answered comprehensively enough. Can men and women be friends? My stepmother, who I adore but disagree with on this one point, is absolutely adamant that men and women cannot be friends. She thinks one or the other of them will be sexually attracted to the other or romantically obsessed with the other, and that completely destroys whatever platonic relationship you might have had. A lot of people agree with my stepmother. Mm. A lot of people of a particular generation, a lot of people, we've even had, I think in the States, certain politicians say they can't be trusted to be in the company of a woman one-on-one without supervision. So there's a lot of kind of talk about how men and women can't possibly get on a friendship level. So both psychological science, my own experience, and increasingly pop culture is now starting to tell us that that's not entirely true. I mean, if you look at evolutionary science, there's no evolutionary need for women and men to be friends. So I like to think of people who are friends with the opposite sex as these beautiful renegades who just do it for the fun of it.
Oh, yes. You have this beautiful line, platonic friendship. I have this quoted. I love it. Platonic friendship is an act of rebellion between two beautiful people who don't need an evolutionary reason to hang out. I love it. The idea that it's like, it's punk, you know, it's saying I'm not driven by my programming in any way. I'll do whatever I want. Let's be friends.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's really interesting because one of the biggest arguments against male-female friendship is sexual attraction. Hmm. A lot of people say that if you fancy the other person, it's not possible to be friends with them. But one of my favorite studies that I discovered in my research was this one from America where basically the researchers were shocked by their own findings. They spoke to a number of different male-female best friends who had slept together in college. Researchers love to speak to college students mm-hmm. because they're at this like great vulnerable kind of stage of their lives where their sex lives are just developing, they're working out who they are as adults, they're kind of just this great research pool.
Oh yeah, and they're right there.
Yeah, and well, exactly. They're on the university campus, so it's easy to get to. Exactly. So I spoke to a lot of college people who'd slept with someone and then stayed friends, and or who hadn't. But basically, the conclusion, which they found shocking, was that for a lot of people they spoke to, the sex actually improved the friendship after.
Yeah, 71% in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is so funny because it goes against this whole overarching narrative we have where people say, you know, I don't want to sleep with you because I don't want to ruin our friendship. And we think that we can't possibly hold two things in mind or in our hearts at once, which is friendship and sexual attraction. I mean, I've been attracted to plenty of my friends and remain friends with them. You know, I've kissed a couple of my very close male friends and we've managed to have the kind of emotional maturity to move on with it mm-hmm. and still keep each other in our lives. You know, even in my own relationship now, my boyfriend has slept with his closest female friend and I don't feel threatened by it. I think we have to sort of give each other permission, particularly in a romantic scenario, to be friends with the opposite sex because, and this is the most important part of this conversation, it can be a really beautiful, important thing. I mean, I've spoken plenty about how important I think female friendship is for women. I think male friendship is incredibly important for men. But I think getting something from the other gender can be so enlightening and interesting. I mean, I realized I had to suffer for my art. And after I'd done research on strangers, I decided to interview the one boy in my life. And I say boy because he's been my friend since I was about 12 or 13. So I feel like he's eternally a boy. But we kissed when we were teenagers, and I was aware of him having feelings for me throughout our teenage years. And I basically interviewed him over Skype, because he lives back in Australia, about why we never got into a romantic relationship and why that's not a failure, but rather why we chose our friendship over any prospect we might have had as lovers or, you know, the loves of each other's lives. And what we do is basically encourage male or female attributes in each other. So I give him a safe space for being open and vulnerable. And, you know, I invite him out to brunch and we gossip and talk about our feelings, which he may not do with his male friends. Or in fact, I know for a fact he does not do regularly with his male friends. Mm-hmm. Whereas he encourages me to be a bit more brash, to be a bit more traditionally male, or, you know, what we consider traditionally male attributes. He makes me sort of unashamed of my ambition. He makes me talk about sex more openly. He makes me kind of increase my confidence in a way that perhaps a white male would. So we sort of offer each other little glimpses into what it's like to be someone of the opposite sex. And that has been really constructive and interesting to me over a long period of time. So I think, I'm not suggesting that having one friend of the opposite sex in any way kind of gives you authority to speak on what that experience might be like. But it certainly kind of broadens our knowledge of what it's like. It certainly gives us little insights into what it might be to be a man or a woman. And I think there are so many different variables, because, of course, we haven't even spoken about sexuality, because I think, you know, men and women, when they have, you know, sexual orientations that don't match up, can also have beautiful friendships and be really interesting. And there's, you know, one of my best friends in the whole world is a gay man. And I think we became friends so easily and so quickly and so deeply because there was no sexual possibility between us at all. So for me as a woman, that was completely non-threatening and safe. And for him, it was non-threatening and safe for him to express his more feminine sensibilities. So I think there can be so many different variables once you take sexuality into account as well. But it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I like this phrasing you use in the book where you say that people say, you know, we're just friends. And it's like the phrase you talk about how, in your opinion, and I like this a lot, it's really the other way around, saying, you know, we're friends, we're not just lovers, right? We're friends, we're not just mates. And that, you know, if you're going to do a trade-off, you know, and you're saying that you're choosing one or the other, like these people, these are two people who are able to be friends, and they haven't made it just about sex or just about, you know, desire between the two people. They, you know, obviously in a relationship you want to have both, but it's framed as almost like the friendship is the thing you're trying to avoid, which is odd. And, you make a good case that even in situations where two people are friends and they happen to hook up in some way, that it doesn't necessarily or often destroy anything, and it gets it out of the way. And if they can be friends and just let it pass, because it's a different type of emotional connection. It's a different type of attraction to one another, that people aren't brutish, that they can be complex. And I dig it. I don't know. This is I like that section of the book a lot.
Thank you. And I think, I mean, I didn't speak to the point you made earlier about where our flaws belong.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That was really nice.
Thank you so much. I think one of the beautiful things that can happen when you're friends with someone of the opposite sex is that you've actually disregarded them as a romantic possibility. So I have people in my life, or someone I'm thinking of particularly now, who's a male friend. I've completely dismissed him as a romantic prospect. It doesn't matter that I'm in a relationship now. I wasn't in a relationship when we met, and I decided that he was not, for me, compatible in a romantic sense. So we did not pursue that type of relationship. And that has given me the freedom to be openly flawed in a way that I wouldn't be necessarily if I was trying to impress someone in a romantic way. So very quickly, I gave myself permission to be kind of the parts of myself that I don't present when I'm trying to impress someone, basically. And I feel that it's the same for him, that he's been able to be sort of as open about his own personality flaws as possible, because he's not trying to woo me, basically, which means that we've opened up all these different, you know, pockets of honesty in our relationship, where we can be open about our bad behavior, the mistakes we make, the times we've been bad human beings. You know, I have a friend who I just think would be the worst boyfriend in the world, and I told him that. I think he would be abominable, and I know that because he's, you know, I've been there having brunch with him on the, you know, the day after he's done something terrible to a woman. And I, of course, don't condone his behavior, and I try and talk him around from how he treats intimacy and relationships with women, and particularly sex. But I know that I don't want to put myself in that scenario in a romantic sense, but I fully embrace his flawed, full character because I'm allowed to as a friend. And I think friendship can be this wonderful place where we accept people because we're not trying to fit them into a particular role. We're not trying to make them a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And we don't have any sort of list of prerequisite qualities that we need to tick off in order to be in a relationship with them. A friendship is a much freer, more liberal, kind of more open relationship where you can be really flawed and admit your mistakes and talk about when you've been bad. And I think that is kind of revolutionary and wonderful.
I totally agree with that. This is my favorite part of the book, in that, you know, you can give a friend so much shit for who they are.
Yeah.
And you can totally acknowledge, like, I would never in a million years want to live with you or, you know, wash your clothes. But I do think you're a beautiful human being despite these irreconcilable flaws. And I like that the way you phrase it. Our flaws belong somewhere and they belong in these friendships. And I think that's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much.
And we've seen some of this. This is starting to emerge in some of our, even though I've seen this every once in a while in pop culture with, you mentioned, Parks and Recreation, you know, Ron Swanson, Leslie Knope, Liz Lemon and Jack, Donnie and 30 Rock. And in those, in their portrayals of those, the one brings out the masculine in the other and one brings out the feminine in the other. And they, would be the worst pairing of all time. And, but they're really, they can at times be shoulder to shoulder, and at times they can be face to face, and they really, really build each other up because of that. It's really nice to see when it's done well.
Yeah, isn't it beautiful? I mean, I love both of those television shows and both of those friendships because they would, as you say, make the most terrible romantic couples. And I think there's courage from those television writers, because I think in both Parks and Recreation and 30 Rock, the writers have been brave enough to write into some friendships that do not have convenient, satisfying romantic endings. I mean, we had 10 years of the TV show Friends and almost got all six of the primary characters coupled up.
Right,
you know, we got
Monica
and Chandler, we got Rachel and Ross, and apparently rumor has it was meant to be Phoebe and Joey, except then Paul Rudd came in and was so fantastic they had to write him into the ending. So a TV show about friendship almost ended up with the moral of the whole story being that romantic love supersedes it.
That's true.
I think it's really courageous when we start having these different exciting representations of friendships between men and women, like in those two shows. Because apart from the fact that I think Liz and Jack in 30 Rock kissed once, but it was for a particular reason, and accidentally got married on a boat, there's no even clue or hint that there would be romantic tension between them. It's just this ridiculous, flawed, interesting, exciting friendship that exists between two human beings, regardless of their gender.
Right. I could talk about all this forever, but we have to stop somewhere. I would like to stop in Sardinia. Because this is, I had seen this before, and it's, and you write about it so well, and it's just one of those things that you're like, oh, that's the secret up to life. So, tell us some interesting facts about Sardinia and what, researchers have discovered when they tried to figure out why it's so different there.
Well, I don't know if you've been to Sardinia, but it is a beautiful place in Italy. But the most fascinating thing about it, apart from pizza and pasta and sunshine and beautiful culture, is that it has more people over the age of 100 than in all of North America. Mm-hmm. So this quite small place in Italy has this very strange overrepresentation of centenarians.
Mm-hmm. And not just that, they have less inflammation, they have low blood pressure.
And they're really healthy 100-year-olds. It's bizarre. It's like this wonderful alternate universe where people have found the secret to long life and good health.
But they're eating pasta and pizza. And
yeah, exactly. The most famous and delectable and desirable specialty of this place in Sardinia is this sort of like ravioli, but a slightly different type of pasta, but basically little packages of cheese in swathed tomato sauce. And this is what all the nonnas make for the rest of their family, and they just gorge themselves on it, which is, you know, one of the beautiful things about Italian culture. So it's, you know, basically researchers looked at this place where these people kept outliving everyone else, and they said, look, it's obviously not diet. It's not a secret to their diet, because they're sort of living this, you know, carb-rich, fantastic diet that goes against all sorts of other sort of wellness myths. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, there's nothing unique about the environment. There's no kind of fountain of youth or secret, you know, part of the ocean they're bathing in to prolong their lives. Mm-hmm. The secret, basically, that Sardinians have discovered is friendship. It's companionship. When researchers went to interview people who lived over the age of 100, they were always, without exception, surrounded by their friends and family during the interviews. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, because it's Italy, these interviews took place in the kitchen, around the kitchen table, and there were always, you know, a cousin or an auntie or a best friend hanging about, because in this very small town in Sardinia, the buildings are all really close to one another. Everyone lives with everyone else. Even in their old age, they're living with their friends. They're not in care homes. They're not in retirement villages. They're not in assisted care buildings. They're able to live at home and be mobile and be healthy because they're surrounded by their friends. Mm-hmm. And basically, once scientists eliminate all the other factors in their life that could be contributing to this long life and also level of health, they have to come to the conclusion that the only thing that is setting aside these people is their approach to companionship.
Yes. So, I mean, some things just for the audience to, like, these people aren't in utopia. They are assholes to each other. They are grumpy. There are people that they're like their uncles and they don't like them around. And there are family spats, friends go in and out. I mean, this is not utopia. And sometimes there are people who smoke and there are people who eat too much. And there's still politics and everything else that everybody else has. But what they, mm-hmm. but what's different, you know, in this world, in this place where men live as long as women, people often live to be older than 100 years old. They have fantastic health. They look great and they're happy. Is that they do know who their neighbors are. They know who all of their neighbors are, and their neighbors move in and through their lives, and their friends and family are around them constantly. And every opportunity they have to have a big meal with everyone they know surrounding them, they do. And they spend their days together and they play games together, and their culture has positioned itself with a different set of values that are not about this hardcore, hard-shelled individuality. And though they can still have individuality, it's not at the expense of all these other things. And it's this beautiful example of nature and nurture, where they've culturally chosen a different way to be, and their nature has responded in a really nice way.
Yeah. Oh, it's so beautiful. I've always had this fantasy of forcing my friends to sort of co-purchase a big house somewhere in the country. and live together and just force all their spouses into and their children into the same one big rambling house that we all own together. And, you know, as it turns out, I keep trying to convince them. I keep trying to bring up the Sardinian example and say, you know, it's not some ridiculous fantasy of mine. It's actually the single greatest thing we could do for our health and longevity. So I'm working on that.
Yeah. I don't know. Something about this excites me in that I know that this is how we lived for a very long time, and then the Industrial Revolution happened, and we're at the tail end maybe of a big weird blip in human history where we're living in a very alien way, you know, a very strangely non-communal way. We often do strange stuff to like yank ourselves back into that if we can do it, whether it's like Burning Man type things or even, you know, or even making communes or whatever people do. But I often find that when I do get a chance to be with my circle of friends or in a big family get together, even when it's terrible, it's not somehow.
Yeah.
And I mean, these people who live in this area, I mean, they have lower incidences of everything: Alzheimer's, heart disease, lung cancer. It's wild. There's obviously a stressor. It's obviously a stressor in our lives. I don't know. I can't take it. It's just something about it that I love. It's obviously a very large stressor to be constantly curating this selfness that is not really fun to carry around, and to not be able to have these permeable membranes between other people around us where we can share what's happening to us whenever things are a little too much, and just kind of get course corrected enough so that we don't have to have these major course corrections when things always completely fall apart, and then you've been saving up all this stuff for so long and you just bleh, all of it out at once. Having those close connections allow you to have these micro corrections as you move forward, and it obviously is very good for us.
Absolutely. I think our gut instinct would probably tell us that, but now if we read the right things, science is actually telling us that as well. So it's kind of incontrovertible that friendship is the most sensible thing we can do for our health.
And that's why you call it the friendship cure.
And that's exactly why I called the book the friendship cure.
I know I kept you a little longer than I said it would, but I really enjoyed your book. And when I approached it, I was like, well, it was going to be another pop science book that I was going to be like, meh. But then you got me.
Oh, thank you. I'm so pleased.
What's the best way for people to reach you if they want to keep up with all your stuff?
I'm on Twitter. It's Kate I. Lever. I'm on Instagram as the same. That's probably the best place. Or I'm on katelever.com, which is where you can find all my writing and any other details.
Okay. And what do you have coming up next?
Well, next, to be honest, I will just continue my career as a freelance journalist and wait for the next book idea to come to me.
good luck. And thank you so much for all of this.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Same.
That is it for this episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. For links to everything else that we talked about in this episode, head to youarenotsosmart.com. You'll find previous episodes and transcripts and show notes and much more. The opening music is Clash by Caravan Palace. You can follow You Are Not So Smart at Not Smart Blog on Twitter, or just / You Are Not So Smart on pretty much everything else like Facebook. If you would like to support the show, you can do that over at patreon.com/youarenotsosmart. Pitching in at any amount gets you the show with no advertising, but at the higher amounts, you can get signed books, posters, clothes, all sorts of cool things. And if you like the show, please do that. Please support it. And please tell everybody you know to listen to the show. It is actually growing quite quickly right now because of your efforts to tell everyone about it. I really appreciate that. Please do more of that. I prefer the organic spread of the show over having to plug it on every social media service. So really, I can't thank you enough for continuing to keep this show going, contributing, and making it your own, suggesting ideas. I love it.